You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to help you plan that unbelievable travel experience. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
For decades, milk has been fueling women marathon runners as the OG performance drink. And in the new docuseries Running Sucks, brought to you by Team Milk, Abby Ayers takes us on a journey of self-discovery as she meets several groups of empowered women runners to find out what drives them, what fuels them, and what pushes them to go the distance. And in the process, she learns that she too can be a distance runner. You can watch the series at runningsucktheseries.com and register for the inaugural Every Woman's Marathon at everywomansmarathon.com.
Hello and welcome to the Long Form Podcast. I'm Evan Ratliff from Atavist. I'm here with Max Linsky. To my left, to my right, Aaron Lammer.
Is that stage left or audience left?
I'm just trying. I've been listening to a lot of soccer games on the radio. I'm trying to get
of a picture. We're excited to announce our live Broadway show.
Don't make jokes about live radio shows. That's a people be doing those.
Who'd you talk to this week, Evan?
I talked to John Heilemann, who is an old friend of mine. I fact-checked his work when I worked at Wired a long time ago. And a book of his, and he has since gone on to write some books that you may have heard of, like Game Change, which then got turned into a movie.
Heard of that one?
Game Double Change. Down.
What is the Game Change movie like?
Pretty good. I saw it. It's HBO. Yeah. HBO movie. Yeah.
Who plays who?
Julianne Moore plays Sarah Palin.
Spot on.
Yeah, she kills it.
It's about right.
And I think Ed Harris plays John McCain. Is that right?
Yeah, I think so.
It's pretty good stuff. I meant to ask Heilemann about. He appears in it as like an extra in some scene, but I forgot to ask him about it. So,
Max, do we have any sponsors this week?
We have one sponsor, but it's our favorite sponsor.
Tiny Letter.
That's the one.
It's a simple, powerful way to send an email newsletter. It's from the people at MailChimp. Tiny Letters are all over the place. David Carr had a column about Tiny Letters. You're missing out if you're not either reading or writing a Tiny Letter, I'd say.
It's true. You guys going to start Tiny Letters?
Maybe I already have one.
You got nothing to say.
You got a secret tiny letter?
or do I? Here is Evan and John Heilemann. Heilemann.
Heilemann.
Heilemann.
Welcome to the podcast, John Heilemann.
Evan Ratliff.
Yeah.
Happy to be here.
I would say we've known each other for a while now, for some years.
I'm certain that we met in the summer of 2000.
Summer of 2000. So that's when you were working on the Microsoft article and then book.
In San Francisco, California.
But here's where I wanted to start because normally we don't start with like a chronological approach. But I feel like people see on TV, they know Game Change, like they see a New York Magazine, and they might find it hard to envision the like John Heilemann who's like the young guy at a magazine who's like, I don't know, getting people coffee or whatever. I don't have any idea how you started. I know you started at The Economist.
Yeah, I was never that guy getting people coffee. Luckily, I mean, I say, but not a sense of arrogance, but just a sense of luck.
Where did you come from? Where'd you grow up?
I grew up in Los Angeles, California, in the San Fernando Valley, in a town called Canoga Park that still exists, although at some point after I left in the mid-1980s, they, as urban planners are wont to do, they chopped Canoga Park in half, and they left the part that was filled with porn studios and Hispanics and called it Canoga Park, and took the part that was filled with white people and called it West Hills,
Nice.
which raised the property values for people like my father, who was an aerospace engineer and like a totally middle-class guy, but like his house suddenly went from being worth $200,000 to worth $350,000, and it was like, wow, just because they changed the name of the neighborhood and excluded all the like undesirables. So I grew up in this totally suburban, totally in the heart of suburban California.
And did you have literary aspirations as a kid?
Pretty much always, yeah. I went to Catholic high school I had a really, a number of really inspirational English teachers in high school, and one of whom gave us an assignment to write an essay about poetry, and was broad-minded enough to let me write an essay about Paul Simon and Bob Dylan. And I remember writing that thing and finishing writing it and being like, this is what I want to do. Huh. Not necessarily be a music critic or a poetry critic or whatever, but like that, like I wrote something that was like the longest thing I had probably ever written to that point. I don't remember how long it was, but I have a very vivid memory of finishing it, turning it in, being proud of it and thinking like writing would be a good thing to do. I didn't know what kind of writing. I didn't know if it would be journalism or fiction or criticism or whatever, but that I thought, you know, that was great. And I had felt a sense of satisfaction doing it that I had never had before. And pretty much from that point on, I like was figuring out what kind of writing it was going to be, not whether I was going to write or not.
Huh. And did you always feel you, in addition to being, it was satisfying as an experience, did you feel like you had an instant competency at it, that it was something that you excelled at, or is something that you...
It came easily to me. I enjoyed it. Yeah. It's funny way, I enjoyed it more then than I do now, in the sense that like I'm more tortured by it now than I was then. The more you know about how good it could be, the more you realize that you're falling so far short of how really great writers write. So at the time, it came easily to me, and I enjoyed doing it, and I took satisfaction from it. And the people who read the things that I wrote told me that I was good at it, so I believed them, and they were, you know, the most important teachers that I had when I was at that age, through high school at least, were English teachers, and all of them had the sense that I was good at it. Yeah, so I thought about where to go to school, and the one that I had decided I was going to go to no matter what was to go to Northwestern, because of the journalism program there. And it was the only school in the country that had a journalism program, but also a really good liberal arts college. It was like, if you went to like the University of Missouri to go to the journalism school, like you weren't really going to get a good liberal arts education, but you could go to Northwestern and be in the J school.
As an undergrad.
But also do a political science double major and be like, you know, get a really good political science education. And my whole thing was like, I wanted to learn some of the basic journalism stuff, but I also really wanted to get like a real actual undergraduate education.
Yeah.
So it was like, that's why I decided to go there. And it was pretty much the only school I was like, it was like, if I got in there, I was going to go there. Hmm. And I got in there early and just said, okay, I'm going.
And then how did you get into a job that wasn't the sort of, you know, like intern opening the mail or whatever job? Like, how did you go from there to...
In my senior year, I was thinking about going to grad school, and I had a bunch of interesting job offers, including a job offer at Variety and a job offer at Rolling Stone and a couple that were like internee jobs, like, you know, not like real jobs. They were like, you know, just like they would have been mailroom, you know, pouring people coffee jobs. And I also had this girlfriend who I was really into, and she decided she was going to move to Washington and work on Capitol Hill. I'd applied to a bunch of different kinds of graduate schools, some in journalism, some in politics, and I blew it all off and decided just I was going to follow this chick to D.C. So I went to Washington without any idea what the fuck I was going to do there.
Hmm.
And ended up working in an office on Capitol Hill and as a bartender in Georgetown at this bar called Garrett's. And
I know Garrett's out of business now, right?
Yeah.
When the last time I was there.
Yeah. Yeah.
Pretty recently, though.
It was a great bar, and it lasted for a long time. And I met a lot of great people there. I had all these weird things that happened that year, including sharing a beach house that summer of 1987, summer of 1988 with Anthony Weiner. Which is one of the weirder things in my background. And, you know, Anthony was really good friends with Jon Stewart. So Jon Stewart and I, like, Jon Stewart was around all the time in our beach house in Dewey Beach, Delaware. Again, at the time.
That is something.
At the time, who knew that these people would turn into who they turned into? But that was all a fact. But I knew I was not going to stay on Capitol Hill. And I worked for this incredibly corrupt congressman. I was working as the press secretary for the chairman of the House Banking Committee, this guy named Freddie St. Germain from Rhode Island, who probably more than any single legislator in the history of the Republic caused the savings and loan crisis in the 1980s by deregulating the SNLs. There were a bunch of corrupt congressmen then on the Democratic side, Rostenkowski and Jim Wright, the speaker. And he was in that class of this old kind of perfumed kind of like, I mean, you couldn't make them up kind of level of corruption.
And Rhode Island at that time.
And Rhode Island, and even now. Yeah, it's pretty corrupt culture. So I had a kind of amazing experience there. But he was the chairman of a committee. So, I learned a lot actually working for him, even though I didn't. I really just took the job because I wanted to be in D.C. And like my girlfriend worked in Rayburn. And I thought if I could get a job in Rayburn, that'd be great because we'd be closer to each other. You know, it was all driven by a girl. And I thought I'd go back to grad school, and I knew I was going to, but I was very focused on doing grad school but using that as a stepping stone to like doing a journalism thing. And I went to the Kennedy School at Harvard Because I thought it would be good to, like, if I was going to write about politics. And I had been kind of wavering between whether I would write about pop culture or whether I would write about politics. And there were two things that really interested me, that continue to interest me. And I went to the Kennedy School kind of thinking that I was kind of making my choice and that politics was what I would write about. And so I spent 2 years there. And the summer between those 2 years, I was an intern at the Washington Monthly.
Oh, a lot of good people came out of the Monthly.
Which a lot of good people came out of, yeah. And I wrote for the Monthly. And I published a couple pieces there. And in fact, the first one I published was the first one that was edited by an incoming, the Monthly used to have these two editors. Mm-hmm. And they were on an alternating schedule. You did a 2 year thing there and you made like $12,000 a year. And then you went on to bigger things and became James Fallows or, became Taylor Branch or whoever you were going to become. But there was this kid coming in who was about to take over at the end of the summer as one of the two. And one of the new editor in the rotation was this kid named James Bennett, who now is the editor of The Atlantic. The first piece that I published in a national magazine was the first piece that James edited in a national magazine. Hmm. And that sort of kicked off what has, to this day, remains like an incredibly close friendship.
And you also, didn't you intersect somewhat famously with Barack Obama when you were at Harvard? Like you shared a smoke with him or something? I saw that in some footnote.
We did, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I always like really try to clarify on this story because it's funny, but it's the truth is, not a friend of mine, not like a guy I hung out with, but... we did live like about two blocks from each other in Somerville. He started at the law school in the fall of 1988, and I started at the Kennedy School in the fall of 1988. And we lived a block and a half away from each other and had to walk the same walk by the Harvard Divinity School to get to where we went to. So he was really good friends with – he was like 3 degrees of separation away. Huh. I knew a lot of law students. I lived with a law student, and I knew all these people who knew him. And so – and he was a big figure on campus. He was like older. Like in the law school world, he was older than a lot of the law students who had come right out of college. He was like 4, 5, 6 years older. He was this, impressive dude who had clear political aspirations and was in his classes, was seen as being a, in a very hyper-competitive environment. People identified him early as someone who was like a standout at Harvard Law School. And in that environment, you have to be badass to get identified that way.
Yeah.
Because everyone thinks everyone thinks they're the shit of the shit. Right?
Yeah.
So you would hear about Barack Obama, and I met him through a mutual friend who introduced me to him on the steps of the Langdale Library one day, and I was smoking cigarettes and standing around, and he came up and introduced this tall, thin, kind of striking African-American guy and said, "This is Barack Obama," and I said, "Hey." Later, it's like, wow, the first words you spoke to a future president, and right. He looked at me and said, "Hey, man, can I bum a smoke?" And I said, "Sure," and we stood there and smoked a cigarette, and again, I would, would play basketball together a couple times. I played in a poker game with him once. It's like, not like we weren't buddies. But,
yeah.
But you, again, people kept their eye on him, right? And I was there. My second year was the year that he was in the competition to become the president of the Law Review.
Right.
And that
right.
got national attention.
Right. That was a good deal.
Written about in the New York Times.
Yeah. So you knew he was kind of.
Yeah. Yeah. It was enough entree that from a journalistic standpoint, it's like, oh, hey, I know that guy.
Yeah.
Looking for that little shared thing is the thing that can sometimes get you in the door.
You know,
is that little thing of, I knew that guy at Harvard vaguely. He knows my friend so-and-so. Oh, yeah, hey, well, he got in the car with us and ride with us, So I shamelessly used that connection to my advantage throughout his career.
I was also wondering, you mentioned the Anthony Weiner thing or John Stewart. Like, is there some way in which, being around those people who then became very prominent in these different ways made you feel more like a peer to them and less?
Yeah, I think, there's definitely, I don't think this is at all unique to me. If you're Joe Klein and you were, writing in the Boston Phoenix in 1972 or 1974, and you were the same age as John Kerry, and John Kerry came home from Vietnam and threw his medals over the wall, you have a different kind of relationship with John Kerry for the rest of your life than you will have with the guys who were 10 years older or 20 years older.
Right.
Every generation of political journalists has some class of people. Either they're the first, the people that they were freshman congressmen when they first started covering Capitol Hill or whatever the thing is. And those people you have a different relationship with than people who were, big grandees, that when you were young. So. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's complicated, when something goes wildly wrong with someone's life, like Anthony, who, I've known forever, right? it becomes complicated and weird. And it's not like he's a great friend of mine, but still I've known him for a long time,
Yeah.
But I really don't think that's unusual or unique to me. I think it's like every generation, you look at the people who are your age, in a different way, just as you look at the ones who are now younger. I'm 48 now. And so when I see like these young hotshot congressmen or whatever who are 32, it's a different relationship than, if you were 10 years younger and you kind of look at them like, I know more about Capitol Hill than you do. I just do, you know, because you're 32. I know what it was like to be 32 and you just got here and you don't know anything. And so it changes the nature of the relationship that you have with them in the same way that, you know, your age and relative, you know, relationship changes the nature of the interplay that you have with people in politics, for sure.
So you went to Kennedy School and then...
I got out at the fall of 1990, and I had two job offers, one of which was to go work for U.S. News and World Report, which was actually a magazine back in those days. You may remember it. I don't know.
It was for a while. It was sort of like Time, Newsweek, U.S.
There were,
News.
There were three news magazines then, and they were all competing, and they offered me a job that was like an actual like reporting job, but like the most base level reporting job you could get offered in Washington, basically on the back of these two pieces I'd written for the Washington Monthly. And then I got this phone call from this guy who was the Washington bureau chief of The Economist, who was a guy named Mike Elliott, who went on to be a lot of different things. He now runs the One campaign for Bono, He was also the international editor. He later became the international editor for Newsweek and was the international editor for Time and did a lot of things and is like a very close friend of mine now. At the time, he was just this British guy on the phone who called up and said that he knew about me from the Monthly and, you know, would I like to apply for an internship in his office? And I was like, you know, I have a job offer, you know, like, and he said, well, you know, come see me, like, you know, well, you know, like, let's have a chat. And I didn't really know that much about The Economist, but I met this guy and I liked him. And he said, look, you know, this is an internship, but it's a congressional election year. You'll come here in the summer. You'll spend, you know, the summer and the fall here. And then, you know, you can eat, you know, this is how The Economist works, is that internships are like tryouts. And like, if you write your way onto the magazine, you'll, at the end of this, you'll have a job offer. And that job offer will probably be in London. And it'll probably be like, here's what it'll be like if you get a job offer here. And here's what your life will be like if you stay at US News, if you go to US News. And I sort of thought that was like a kind of like roll of the dice I was willing to take, you know? So I went there and I wrote a lot. I mean, it was clear that this was an internship at which you were going to be expected to write, like, and write for the magazine, and not like it was not going to be like a photocopying, like, for other people, doing research for other people internship. So I wrote a bunch of pieces, and they liked them. And at the end of it, they said, "Hey, come to London, and you know a lot about politics." And I said, "Yeah." And they said, "So we want to give you a job writing about business." And I didn't know shit about business, like,
in London?
Nothing, zero. Yeah, I didn't know anything about it. And I said, that's sort of fucked up, you know? And the guy who was the editor then of The Economist, which was just then emerging from becoming a quirky British magazine that had been around for 150 years, that had a few readers in America who were mostly like librarians, to being like this global powerhouse under this one guy named Rupert Pennant Ray, who later became the deputy governor of the Bank of England and then got involved in a sex scandal that led to one of the great tabloid headlines ever in British history, called where he got caught screwing his mistress in the Bank of England. And so they ran a headline, I believe in the Sun, that was called "The Bonk of England," which was like, it's one of my favorite things ever. So Rupert, who really was like a character from Monty Python sketch, he was actually from South Africa. He was a genius in some ways, and he was basically had identified that there was a emerging market for a cosmopolitan business class of readers that The Economist could appeal to. And he was in the process of turning the magazine from what I described before into what it is now, which is like this totally global, totally international, appealing to that cosmopolitan business traveler set. Not like the richest people in the world, actually, but like the kind of people who get on planes a lot and fly everywhere and need to be able to digest information really fast. Again, pre-internet, right?
And want to feel smart.
The whole magazine had this identity. There were no bylines, and the magazine had this singular voice, and they had stringers over 150 years. They developed this amazing stringer network all over the world. So the best guy in Nairobi who worked for the paper there, or the best guy at the Jerusalem Post, also dug the idea of writing for The Economist even without a byline. And so they had these incredible writers. And then they had all these sub-editors in London who would sub everything and make it all sound like it was the same thing. And there was already like a lot of money there. Like, it was making money, like hand over fist. It was very profitable. So it was a place where Rupert had this attitude with me where he said, look, you know about politics, and probably you'll end up writing about politics at this magazine, but like, I like the idea of taking smart young generalists and throwing them at things they know nothing about, because rather than going in with a bunch of preconceived questions because you already know about the auto industry or the advertising industry, you're going to go in and ask, like, with a fresh set of eyes, you're going to ask a bunch of questions that like are off the wall and mm-hmm. quirky and weird, and you're going to get interesting answers and write interesting articles. And I sort of said, yeah, all right, fine. Like, it wouldn't be a bad thing to learn how to, like, read a P&L and a balance sheet, which yeah. they'll teach me to do.
Yeah.
And as it happened, and this probably was the key thing, was that the guy who is now the editor of The Economist, John Micklethwaite, was just leaving what was, to my mind, the only business beat that I really was interested in that seemed like fun to me, which was the global media business beat, and was going to move to LA and become the first Economist Los Angeles correspondent. And at that point in the early 90s, Rupert Murdoch, Robert Maxwell, all of these kind of media titans, you know, Time Warner, the Time Warner merger, the original Time Warner merger, Time and Warner, had just happened. And it was an era of like big media deals and the beginning of discussions of information superhighway and synergy and vertical integration and all this stuff.
It's like everything was on the rise before it all went to shit.
Right, exactly. But it was like there were big characters.
Yeah.
And big money and big debt and big deals. And I thought, well, shit, that sounds like that'd be kind of fun to do, right? So I took that gig and I spent the next 3 years doing a thing that like every 24-year-old would dream of doing. Like, this is just, again, I've given you the narrative, right? Blind shithouse luck in a certain ways. I don't know how it all kind of ended up here, but you had all these like 30-year-old reporters who had kids, and like, even though The Economist had all this money, and would say to the business writer who covered the chemicals industry, you know, please go travel, you know.
Anywhere
they would
go.
Say, I don't really want to travel. I want to stay home with my wife and kids. And I was like, I want to go everywhere. And every time, there was never a constraint. There was never like, stay here and write it cheaper. It was like, get on the plane. And with the Economist credentials, you could talk to anybody anywhere. You could go see the head of Dentsu, the biggest advertising agency in Japan, or you could go meet Rupert Murdoch in Hong Kong when he was about to buy Star TV, which was the biggest satellite network in Hong Kong. And so I spent 3 years, like my life was, I'd fly from London to Hong Kong and from Hong Kong to Tokyo and Tokyo to LA and LA back to London and then to Paris and then to Rome and then to New York and then to Moscow and then to, you know, I just spent 3 years using the money of The Economist to travel around the world and writing like fucking crazy.
Did you think your sort of like reporting chops developed during that time?
Yeah. And I would say, you know, The Economist is a weird thing because it's a very limited palette. They don't do profiles, really.
Mm-hmm.
What they do really, really, really well, though, is exposition and analysis. Like, how do you take a complicated subject and distill it into a really clear framework that explains what's going on here and applies some kind of an analytical eye to it. If you had the attitude of this is a really great educational opportunity as well as like a fuck of a lot of fun, you know, you could learn a lot.
And then did you go straight to, I know you had like a dual like Wired.com and New Yorker gig.
I did these 3 years in London, then I went to Washington for The Economist and got back to politics. And I spent a couple years there doing that in 94 and 95. One of the most vivid memories of my life I'll never forget was the day in Paris at a friend of mine's apartment, who was a management consultant, picking up the first issue of Wired and reading Lewis's manifesto, which described this idea for a magazine, which was, this is going to be a magazine. The digital revolution is changing our lives, and it's like a Bengali typhoon. And this is going to be a magazine that's going to be about that, but it's not going to be about technology and products. It's going to be about all of the implications of the digital revolution, about the social, economic, political, cultural, all of that. And I read it and thought, this is a fuck. I mean, first of all, I was like, that's a magazine I want to read.
Yeah.
And second of all, it was like, this is a brilliant guy. Like, this is like a great magazine idea. This is a magazine idea like what it must have been like when Jan thought of like how to do Rolling Stone. And I thought, this is the first really original, and you had legs. You know, you could see that was like a story that was going to play for 30 years, right? And it was really brilliantly conceived. And there was a lot of hyperbole in the manifesto, but you could still see the kernel of like, this is like, could be big.
Right? Yeah.
So I got in touch with those guys myself, and I met my friend John Battelle, who was then like one of Lewis's, like one of the original founders there. And so I had started to write for them. I wrote a big piece about the BBC for them in the very, like the second issue or the third issue of Wired. So I had this relationship going on at Wired, and Lewis had this idea because Lewis really did think of himself as the successor to Rolling Stone. He thought that Jan had created this magazine that was for the rock and roll generation of the 60s, and that Wired was this magazine for the digital generation of the early 90s. and he wanted his Hunter Thompson. He'd been in business for a couple of years, and Wired was the hottest magazine in the country. And Lewis was like, in 1996, it's going to be the first presidential election where the web will have existed. And we're going to send somebody out on the trail who's going to write about politics from the perspective of the digital generation. That doesn't mean you're going to write about digital politics, but you're going to be our Hunter Thompson. So we want to hire you to do that. And I said, yeah, that sounds pretty good. And at the same time, I had started writing these Talk of the Town pieces for The New Yorker.
Is it Tina Brown era New Yorker?
Tina Brown era New Yorker. Tina had just come in a couple of years earlier. And they came to me and said, you know, we'd like to have you write every week for Talk of the Town on the campaign. So I was like, okay, so a monthly piece for the magazine, which would be like 6,000 or 8,000 words, and like a weekly piece for The New Yorker. This is a kind of amazing, weird, like old media, new media combination. Like, but the question was, I said to them both, I said, look, man, I want to be what now we would call an embed, you know, but I don't want to be on one campaign. I want to be able to go anywhere I want to go on any given day. I don't want cost to be an issue. I want to be able to get on any plane and fly anywhere and not care. And that includes Air Force One, and that includes a foreign trip by Clinton to Russia or whatever. Like, so they said, how much do you think it's going to cost? And I said, you know, I really forget what the number was, but it was something like, you know, $350,000 or $400,000 for T&E. And Lewis and Tina had some summit.
Where they should point out at this point that some people might know that now Wired and New York are owned by the same company, but that was not true at the
time.
Not
true. Not Condé Nast did not yet own Wired. And so Tina and Lewis sat down and had some incredible kind of tete-a-tete where they tried to figure out how they were going to divide up my expenses. The details of which I do not know to this day, I would like to ask one. I mean, probably neither one of them remember, but I remember Battelle coming to see me in D.C. after this thing and saying, it's done. Like, they're like going to do it. But here's the thing. Lewis has this idea that we're going to start this new thing on the web. Wired is going to have this thing called Hotwired. And Hotwired had actually already started, to be fair.
Uh-huh.
It was the first site on the internet that ever ran banner ads.
Yeah.
Like, and it was like a progenitor of how you're going to actually pay for this incredible new thing back in 1994, 1995. And Lewis is like, I want to start a politics channel on Hotwired, and we're going to call it The Netizen. And as part of this kind of great deal we've got for you, you're going to do a daily post. There was no such thing as a blog at that time. That word did not exist. And Lewis said, you're going to write a couple hundred words, just like some funny thing you see, a little tidbit, so we can have a daily update from the trail with John Heilman, our new Hunter Thompson. And I was like, yeah, all right, that sounds okay. I'll do that. Sure, no problem. So I started in January of 96 doing these things. And about 3 weeks in, I get this call from Lewis, and he says, oh my God, we got the best fucking news in the world. You can't believe how great this story is. What's just happened? I said, what's that? He said, well, the New York Times syndicate wants to syndicate your column for Netizen to all of its newspapers in the New York Times syndicate as a column. And I was like, okay, well, that's great, but like, this isn't really a column. He's like, well, it's a column now. I said, what does that mean? He said, well, you got to write at least 800 words every day. And I said, I got to write 800 words a day, and I'm also writing an 8,000-word piece for your magazine every month, and I'm also writing a piece for Talk of the Town every week. And he's like, yeah. And I took a deep breath and said, okay, let's go. And that's what I did. From January of 1996 to November of 1996, 5 days a week.
That's insane.
I wrote 800 to 1,000 words a day for the web. And then I wrote every issue of the magazine, I wrote a 7,000 to 9,000-word feature. And then I wrote a piece every week, almost every week, in Talk of the Town. And at the end of the year, I published like 175,000 words in total.
It was an era of just a lot of excitement, like politics and tech are coming together. And like,
no. Well, that was the other thing that happened. Lewis was wrong. The 1996 election was not the year of the internet. First of all, the campaign was boring. And second of all, the web didn't really come into its own. None of the campaigns knew how to use it.
Yeah.
And so it was kind of like a curiosity more than it was a real factor.
Huh.
The first thing that really made the internet matter in politics came 2 years later when Drudge emerged and became the vehicle for all the Lewinsky shit. That was when the web became an actual force in actual politics. Drudge really was the person who made the web matter in politics, and it was all around Lewinsky. But when I look back on it, it was a great, great year for me, but I really worked harder that year than I have ever worked, than I had ever worked to that point, and that I ever will work again.
One more thing on this. I'm just curious from a general, in a more general sense, like you mentioned, you said, I want unlimited expenses. I want to be able to go where I want to go.
Yeah. I said I wanted a bureau in Washington. I wanted them to rent me office space. I wanted an assistant. I said all kinds of shit. I had like a T&E budget, and I said, and then I need an office. I'm not doing this out of my house. You're going to go find me office space. I need an assistant who's like dedicated to running my life with travel and doing all this stuff. All that stuff that needs to get paid for.
My question is basically some version of like, where did that come from, that confidence come from? Because I know a lot of writers, they're like, should I ask for $1.60 a word instead of $1.50 a word? You know, like, did you feel like you were in demand and so you should ask for it? Or where did your like confidence in like, I should get this because I can deliver, where did that come from?
Well, I just knew, there were other job offers that I had. So I didn't feel like if this didn't work out, I didn't have anywhere else to go. But I really, like, when I sold the travel thing to Lewis, it wasn't really about confidence. It was just like, listen, here are the things you've now described to me you want. Now let me tell you how much that will cost. If you think that that's more than you want to spend, okay, but then we should talk about a different set of things you want from me, because here's the things you want. I was really just really pricing out what Lewis's ambitions were. If I'm going to be traveling this much and I'm going to be on the road as much as you want me to be, I can't be like booking my plane tickets for myself. In a weird way, it didn't seem like chutzpah. It seemed like this is the rational, if you want X, here's what it's involved. Let me make a list of what X will entail. And these are the things that I need to do it in a reasonably effective way and not kill myself.
Yeah.
In a day that is now seems like a million years ago.
Yeah.
You know, these magazines all were really profitable and all had a lot of money. And Wired was like a hot shit magazine, and every tech company in the fucking country was advertising in it. And it had won a couple of national magazine awards in a row right out of the gate. And people thought it was like this defining zeitgeisty thing. And Wired was that moment, making my money hand over fist. There was a lot of money around. And so.
So then post-campaign, then were you mostly writing for Wired? So we met in the early 2000s. You had been writing more about tech business and then the Microsoft trial.
Well, there's the whole middle part of the story, which is like the great failure of my career, you know, which is that like I came back at the end of 96. Tina wanted me to come and really be full time at The New Yorker. And Adam Moss, who was then at The New York Times Magazine, wanted me to write for The New York Times Magazine full time. So I had to decide between those two things. One of the funniest things that ever happened to me, and again, one of the great mysteries of my life, I went at the end of the year, at the end of the campaign, I decided I was going to go to Costa Rica for a month and just like totally decompress.
Mm-hmm.
And so again, to stay on the train of this conversation, I said to my friend James Bennett, I said, hey, let's go to Costa Rica for a month and just drop out. So like right after Thanksgiving, we went to Costa Rica for a month from like Thanksgiving to Christmas. And we didn't tell anybody where we were going. We just said, we're going to Costa Rica, bye, see you later. And I had decided to put all my job possibilities on hold. I'll figure this out when I get back. And we decided to go to this diving place up in the north of Costa Rica, right on the Nicaraguan border, called this place called El Ocotal. And one day we got out of the water and we were coming back up the hill, and this guy came down from the office of this little crappy hotel we were staying in and said there was a phone call for me. And I said, like, that can't be possible. Like, what do you mean there's a phone call for me? I said, who's like, did the person say who it was? And the guy said, there's some woman named Tina Brown is on the phone for you. And to this day, again, I have no idea how she knew where I was. Like, I have no idea how she found me. It makes no sense. And she was like, you must come back to New York right now. I want you to do a profile on so-and-so. And like, you must come back. And I was like, I'm not coming back. I'm here for like another 5 days. It's 3 days before Christmas. Like, the story can wait. I'll do the story after the first of the year, whatever. So I came back and did this piece. I loved Adam, and I really thought that I might go to the Times Magazine. But in the end, Tina made this case for me. She said, you know, you should quit politics and write about business again. Because politics is now, in a second term of an administration, it's going to be really boring.
Yeah.
You're not going to care, and no one's going to give a shit about Clinton. Now, this is all pre-Lewinsky. You know,
oh.
And 1997 was a really like the start of the year started. It was like, oh, God, there were like congressional investigations about Al Gore and Buddhist temples and all kinds of bullshit. And I was I said, yeah, she said, you know, this technology thing's kind of interesting. You know, you might want to make a name for yourself being the person who is the translator of what's going on out there in the Wired world to what's these people here who read The New Yorker. And I thought, you know, actually kind of makes some sense. That sounds all right. So I took that gig and I wrote this profile in July of 97 of John Doerr, famous venture capitalist behind Netscape, Amazon.com. She said, go do a talk piece on him. And I was like, no, this is like a feature, you know. So I ended up writing like this long feature about John that really changed both of our lives in interesting ways, made him much more famous at that point, and got me a book deal. which was like, go do a David Halberstam kind of book about the history of Silicon Valley.
Yeah.
So I moved to San Francisco in 1998 with the intention of spending a couple years doing like, you know, the reckoning of Silicon Valley. And I mean, the book turned out, it's a book I never wrote.
Yeah.
And I got deep into the weeds and I couldn't figure out how to do the book and I couldn't figure out how to write it. And I had so many different threads and so much stuff. And I was so oppressed by the ambition of it. And I was too young to have taken the deal. Like I didn't really know how to do what I needed to do. I was not, I did not have the narrative chops at that point to write the book that I had signed up to write, is the truth. Like now I know that. At the time I didn't. And I was like in crisis over the fact that the first book deadline came and I missed it and I didn't have the book. I wasn't close to having the book.
I remember, I don't know if we ever talked about this, but I saw it on Amazon once.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
It's just still on Amazon, I think.
Is it really? Pick up a copy.
It was a book. It was going to be called The Valley.
Yeah.
You know, it was like $1 million advance and like there was like a lot of pressure and, you know, and then Tina left The New Yorker and David Remnick came in and was like, I want you to start doing stuff. And I was like, I'm like paralyzed. I can't do anything. I'm like, I was the worst part of my ever in my professional life. I was just totally, completely, utterly blocked and fucked and unable to produce and like in this bad, 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 bad place.
And were you still reporting, just like gathering piles and piles of
reporting?
Reporting
I was still good at.
Yeah.
But I couldn't write. It was my failure. And yet, it is also the case that, like, there's a reason it took David Halberstam 10 years to write The Reckoning, you know, and the reason it took him 10 years to write The Powers That Be. You don't do a book like that in 2 years.
Uh-huh.
You don't. I don't blame the publisher, but we all had unrealistic expectations.
Yeah.
And I collapsed under the weight of them completely to the point of, like, being in, like, a state of, like, close to total nervous breakdown. And Katrina, who by then, Heron, who had then become the editor of Wired, took me aside one day in the offices of Wired and said, I've been listening to you talk about your reporting throughout this entire thing. And, you know, the Microsoft antitrust trial is now happening. And it seems like you have a lot of stuff on that. Like, and you're in this weird position. And I had, like, I thought somehow the Microsoft antitrust trial was going to be like one thread of the narrative of the whole book.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, that'll be like some part of the book. That's how like fucked up I was that I thought that was like a part of the book,
mm-hmm.
right? You know, not like a thing unto itself. It was, so somehow that would fit in another narrative that also included Andy Grove and Steve Jobs and John Doerr and everybody in the world.
It was going to be like the Game of Thrones.
Yeah, it was. I mean, it was insane. It was insane. It was an insane thing. So she said, you know, you have a lot of stuff on this. And so I think what you need to do to make yourself sane is to write something. And so you should tell HarperCollins to back the fuck off and that they'll get a book someday, but like not now. And you should tell Remnick to fuck off and tell him that, like, you know, that unless he wants you to write about the Microsoft trial, which we already know he's assigned to Ken Auletta, you're not going to write anything for him. And you should come here and I'm going to call you special correspondent and you're going to take 6 months and you're going to write a story about the Microsoft antitrust trial for me. And I said, okay. Katrina is like totally like not ever into wallowing in a problem.
Mm-hmm.
Katrina's like into like, okay, like I've now heard your problem. What's the solution to this problem? So she had watched me wallow for a while and then she basically just like picked me up and said, this is what you're doing now. And once I had that direction, I was like in like good shape. And we blocked out 12,000 word version of that story. And I like wrote the first part of it and it was like 4,000 words or 5,000 words. And Katrina was like, I said, I'm like, this isn't like, this is way too much. And she said, keep writing. And I said, okay. And every time I would write another section, it was like, that's like 7,000 words. And it was like, then I wrote the third section. It was like 13,000 words. And I was writing 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 words a day sometimes. Like,
yeah,
I
was just, it was a really tight deadline for something. It was already designated for an issue.
Well, yeah, and it was because the verdict in the trial was coming down and like we knew there was a time, there was a peg to it and it had to get done. But I was writing like a fiend. And the longer it got, the more Katrina was like, do not stop. Like, doesn't matter. I don't care how long it is. And so at the end, you know, of that crazed summer that you were brought into as a fact checker, you know, the first draft of the piece was 65,000 words. And Katrina's like, well, we can't run it at 65,000 words. And I said, yeah, I know. And she said, but we're going to cut it. We'll cut it. And I said, okay, well, you guys cut it. I'm going to I got to finish it, you know. And they cut it from 65,000 words down to 57,000 words.
Yeah. It was basically the whole magazine.
It was the whole magazine. Yeah. We made the magazine. There was nothing else in that magazine except for the front of the book. But the whole feature well was that. I remember being at the end of it and not being able to finish, like the end, literally the end, like the last couple paragraphs, which if you go back and read them now are very, the piece was done, but it didn't have a kicker. And I remember being, I'd been up for like 3 days straight, and Katrina called me from New York from some empty apartment that she was like a friend of hers with no furniture, and she was like on the floor of some apartment in New York, and she called me and like talked me through like what needed to get said in the last like paragraph or two of this piece, which was like a big summation, like a big like Greek tragedy summation about Bill Gates.
Yeah.
And I like finished the conversation and I wrote the thing down and I put it in, and when I got done, I was like, I'm all right, I'm happy with this. And months later, you know, or not months later, a month later, when the magazine came out, David Boies, who was the litigator for the government in the case, was in San Francisco for the Napster trial, which he was also at that point conducting on behalf of Napster.
He's been in everything.
Yes, David
Boies. Bush v. Gore.
Bush v. Gore.
Later. You know, Proposition 8 later.
Truly one of the great, you know, litigators of all time ever, and a great character also in the Microsoft trial story and in many other stories. Well, I drove over to the courthouse where the Napster trial was going on to give David an early bound copy of the Microsoft trial story personally. And it was like a perfect bound copy. It was not even, you know, like the real issue was about to come. The issue was about to come out in about a week.
Yeah.
And I gave it to David as he got in his car to go to San Francisco airport. And David is a crazy reader. He had read the piece while getting drunk. And the people who were with him remember him standing up on the bar at SFO and reading out in like these gratuitously stentorian tones the last two paragraphs of the piece, which were like, you know, that ended with like, you know, Bill Gates was mortal, you know, and he like got up and did this thing, and like people were like applauding at the airport, at San Francisco airport, and there was this whole thing. I mean, most of it was because it was David Boies, right? But like I thought, well, it probably means that the end of the piece is a little too melodramatic, and I probably overwrote it a little bit, but it's still such a fucking good story that I'm like going to be able to dine out on that for a while. So anyway, that piece came out, and I'm still really, really proud of it, you know, and like, you know, when Wired put together their best of collection last year and did it as an e-book thing.
Yeah.
I went back and read it again for the first time in 10 years. And like I read it and was like, yeah, you know, this kind of stands up. It's like there's a lot of good reporting in here. And this is a pretty sound piece of long-form narrative reporting.
And then it became a book. Did the book, did that satisfy your publisher?
Yeah.
For the Silicon Valley books?
Yeah.
Are you off the hook?
Yeah. HarperCollins called up and said, well, why isn't this the book? And I was like, well, it could be the book. And they said, well, you know, 57,000 words isn't really a book. And I said, well, I already got 10 extra thousand words, you know, that we cut. And there's other stuff I can put in. And so I spent like 3 months at the end of that year, you know, building that thing up to be about 95,000 words or something. And we published it as a book in January of 01.
Yeah.
As a book called Pride Before the Fall. You know, it was not a huge commercial success, but like it was like it did pretty well.
Yeah.
And people like wrote nice reviews about it. And like it felt like it was like an okay resolution to what could have been a fucking catastrophe for my career.
So then you ended up at New York Magazine. You were covering the campaign.
Politics, yeah. And just to like tie up the loose end, basically like, you know, because as I mentioned before, Adam had tried to hire me at the New York Times Magazine. And so when I moved to New York, which was really a personal decision, I just decided I wanted to be here because most of my close friends were here. And I realized that like in life that I wanted to be nearer to more people that I was really close friends with, and the exception of Katrina and John Battelle. So I moved out here in 2002. And shortly thereafter, Adam Moss became the editor of New York Magazine. And I didn't really have a gig at that point. I mean, I was still, in theory, special correspondent for Wired. Remnick was mad at me because when he took over, rightly, you know, he had taken over the New Yorker and I was not there for him at the beginning of his tenure. And I had, in fact, done a competitive thing against Ken. So, like, he was pissed. I wasn't going to go back to the New Yorker. And I was like, I didn't really have a job. I wrote a couple pieces for Vanity Fair. I did this and that. But then when Adam took over at New York Magazine, it was like this moment where, oh, you know, we've wanted to work together for a long time, and I need someone. I'm remaking this magazine, and I need someone to be the new political columnist here and the new, like, national politics guy at New York Magazine, in my New York Magazine. Why don't you come do this? And I was like, yeah, let's do that. I've always wanted to work for Adam. He's, like, one of the great magazine makers of our age.
Yeah.
And it was a chance. It seemed like – that seemed like karma, like kismet, you know, like, oh, yes, yes, okay, great. You're taking over this magazine. I just moved here. Let's go. And I – kind of seized control of that beat and it rolled into the 2008 campaign, which turned out to be like the campaign of a lifetime.
Yeah, and I remember you saying at some point that the through line for a lot of this stuff. Like your beat that you've been following all these years was the same beat, and it was Power.
Yeah. The longstanding column in New York Magazine was called The National Interest. It was the column that Joe Klein wrote and the column that Jake Weisberg wrote and the column that a lot of people had written over time. It was the national politics thing. And I said I didn't want to do that, that I would do a lot of politics, but I wanted to also be able to be free to range across business and other things. And so we called that column The Power Grid.
That's
and,
right.
And it was specifically because of this. And I'll tell you, the person who – another person who was in the same world of The Washington Monthly and James Bennett and I back in the early 90s was our friend Kate Boo, who really is, you know, like is really the journalist of our generation and is like really the greatest of like the of my age. But she was the one who said to me one day, it doesn't actually not make sense that you did media and then politics and then technology and now you're back to politics. That's all you ever write about is power. That's all you care about. And like everything you do is tied up by that. And I was like, hadn't seen it really myself, but that was right. And that was part of why we called the column The Power Grid. And it does really kind of animate really most of the things I'm interested in.
Yeah. Looking back at the whole range of magazine stories, I actually only found one, which is also about power in its own way, but that was very different, which was this Lawrence Lessig story that you did about abuse at his high school. And that actually, it stood out that much more because it was this sort of, it was a different kind of magazine story than all these other things kind of like are taking on powerful people in one way or the other.
I mean, that piece is about power.
Yeah.
The power of someone who was a choir school headmaster who abused his power to serially sexually abuse a lot of young choir students, including Larry Lessig. And I wrote the piece because Larry was I was upfront about this in the piece. You know, Larry was someone I was friends with and am still friends with. And Larry told me that story, and he was waging a lawsuit.
Right, he was the lawyer. They brought him in as the lawyer in addition to being a victim.
Yes. And so it was a weird thing. Like, I'd covered obviously some lawsuits, right? A court case in which the litigator is, first of all, a super famous national figure and also is litigating in some sense on behalf of himself because, in fact, he's litigating for all these abused children of whom he was one, though he had never admitted that to anybody before. That story, when Larry told it to me over a kitchen table, like that he was doing this case. I was in San Francisco and said, what are you doing next? He's like, I'm doing this weird case that involves this choir school. And I was like, well, why are you doing that case? Because that has nothing to do with Creative Commons or any of the stuff you've ever done before. And he basically had to say to me, well, the reason I'm doing it is because I was a victim. And I think not in an opportunistic, horrible way. I just sort of was like, well, you know, that's an incredible story. And if you ever wanted to tell it, I would be happy to write it. And Larry thought about it for a while and then came back and said, yes, I would like to tell it because there were a lot of deep issues. He had not told his parents, for instance. In fact, the article was his way of telling his parents that he had been abused. And so he was working through some deep shit of his own. But he made this very independent decision to decide that I was the right writer to do it and that he wanted it done. It's written also in the most plain language of any story I've ever written. Like, there's almost no adjectives or adverbs in it. It's just like very like it's this super, super, super stripped down like version of the story because like the story itself is so powerful that like all the editorial choices and Adam and I really talked about it all the time. We were like just bare bones of the story, like tell it in these very simple direct sentences, like declarative sentences, really simple. Tell the story. Just let the story tell itself. Let it speak for itself. Let the voices speak for themselves. And you don't have to tell anybody anything more than that because the story itself is so rich and so complicated and so powerful that you don't have to embroider it with anything.
Yeah. It's definitely different from like the style of, you know,
almost
things like
else.
Game Changer.
Yeah.
Okay. I got to ask you about these books. These books are obviously like both huge sensations. Like one movie's been made, presumably like a second one may be made out of it. So I have some like general things that I wonder about the process of doing these. One of which is, how does a dual byline situation work? Like, I remember I've watched you write before when I was like fact checking, and it was like the most intense thing I've ever seen of like writing a sentence and then deleting the whole sentence with the like backspace key and being like, no, and like doing it again. And it's sort of hard for me to imagine, like, how does this process work with you and another writer doing entire books?
Well, it's like, you know, we recognize that there's a need for the book to have for these books to have like a, you can't like separate the chapters. You can't sort of say, well, you're going to do the even number chapters and I'm going to do the odd number chapters.
Right.
The starting point is that there's like all these interviews and there's hundreds of them and they're all long interviews. And so there's like thousands of pages, tens of thousands of pages of transcripts that need to be read. And if you're going to decide that you're going to write a book where you take the omniscient voice and you're going to write, this is what happened in this room and these are what people said to each other.
This is what they're thinking.
This is what they're thinking.
In many cases.
And you're not going to say, according to one source, this happened. According to another source, that happened. You really like have to be, you're basically saying, well, my reputation's on the line here, whether this is true or not. And so you have to report the living shit out of it and get to the point where you're really super confident that what you're putting on the page is right. And the distillation of tens of thousands of pages of transcripts where you've asked people the same questions over and over and over again and asked about a certain meeting 20 different ways with 30 different people or 12 different people is an incredibly, like, you know, mind-numbing experience. But when you get all of that material distilled down, we have outlines of these chapters because the books are written in this very kind of like almost screenplay-ish way. Like, you know, we move from big scene to big scene.
Uh-huh.
There's not a lot of exposition. There's not a lot of analytics. It's like it's about like trying to like be big and cinematic and this moving from this big meeting to this big speech to this big thing to this big that. You know, there are like big set pieces that around which the thing moves. If you write a detailed enough outline, it's like the chapter's kind of written already.
Uh-huh.
So someone then needs to write the first draft of it. And sometimes I do that and sometimes Mark does that.
Hmm.
But then, you know, we pass it back and forth. But the reporting is the key to it,
yeah.
You know, in some level. Because there's a lot of dialogue in the books and there's a lot of paraphrase in the books. There's a lot of like, you know, like we want you to be in the room and feel like you're in the room.
It's almost entirely, they're almost entirely that.
And it would be impossible, I think, to do if it was like we're doing analysis. And,
yeah.
And none of this is a diss on analysis or like, you know, books that do analysis. But that's not what these books are. It's not what we're trying to do. You know, we're trying to like basically tell this human story of like these are these incredibly insanely vain, narcissistic, brilliant, idealistic, all of the above people in the greatest competition in American life to try to like win the ultimate prize of power, you know, to win the White House. And what's it like for them to go through that process, which is an insane process, right? Like this combination flash incinerator, meat grinder, a thing that we put our political leaders through to become president. And one of the things that's most frustrating when people criticize the books is like they criticize the books for not having certain things in them. And it's like, it's not like we forgot.
Uh-huh.
It's not like we left those things out like by accident because we're too dumb.
Like
it's
an like, analysis of healthcare,
right,
opposing
like,
healthcare plans or something.
That's not the book we're writing.
Uh-huh.
Now, you might decide that this kind of book is useless and you shouldn't read it. Okay, that's fine with me. I mean, like I can live with that. But like, I'm a big believer in like plurality and democracy. Like, you know, let 1,000 flowers bloom and let 1,000 different kinds of journalism bloom about campaigns and let people, you know, pick and choose of the kind of story they want to read about it. And so I'm really interested in demography and in policy and in analysis and in all kinds of stuff. And I read all those books and I think they're fascinating.
Yeah. How do you decide about Scoops? I mean, both these books came out, that when the book came out with a splash even months after the election, because they had pretty big scoops in the first case, like the John Edwards stuff detail, and the second one, the Hillary Clinton for Biden switch.
Yeah.
Are you with your like New York Magazine stuff, do you not have to put all the scoops into the stuff you're writing during the campaign? Can you hold stuff back or how do you decide that?
Well, the first thing we do is we say to the extent, like there's a bunch of interviews that get done, right? Some of them get done during the campaign. Some of them get done after the campaign.
Mm-hmm.
The vast majority of the interviews that we do take place after the election is over. So like really from like we did interviews on the last book on Double Down. We started doing interviews in the summer of 2010. We need you to sit down with us for 3 or 4 hours and really talk about shit, number one. And most people don't have that kind of time.
Mm-hmm.
So getting the kind of opportunity is hard in the middle of a campaign. Secondly, we say to people in a very distinct way, this is an interview for a book. This is embargoed for after Election Day. You know, with Adam, I would say, I'm doing two different kinds of interviews. When I'm working on a magazine piece, it's a magazine piece. And I'm telling people this is a magazine piece and this will go in the magazine next week. Or it would be Mark and I saying, you know, this is for a book that's going to come out after Election Day. And anything you say here, we will not report until after Election Day. That is the embargo. we have no incentive to screw you, because as soon as we screw you, all of your colleagues are going to know that we screwed you, and you know, nobody will ever talk to us again. So you have two categories of interview. Even if you make that promise to people, and even if they believe you, the truth is that human nature is that no one really, really is free to be totally open about what's going on until after Election Day.
Yeah.
So though we do a bunch of interviews, we did in Double Down a bunch of interviews in 2010, some in 2011, some in the summer of 2012. I would say that of the valuable material that appears in Double Down, that 90% of it was stuff that we got after Election Day.
Uh-huh.
There's this period of about 6 months where we're doing 7 days a week from 8 o'clock or 7 o'clock in the morning till like midnight, like 3 or 4 or 5, 2 or 3 or 4 hour long interviews a day, just people stacked up. And that period is when almost everything that you would think that the world thinks is, quote, a scoop
comes from
that period from November till April.
So when you did Game Change, was there a feeling that like it was going to be a sensation because that campaign was so intense and there was so much to it? Or was it just like, let's do a campaign book and there'll be 200 campaign books that'll come out that year?
When we didn't decide to do it until April or May of 2012.
Uh-huh.
And at that point, the publishing industry had decided that campaign books were commercially losing propositions. Part of it was driven by what had happened with Richard Ben Kramer's book, where What It Takes, which is one of the, you know, the magisterial books of campaign coverage ever. Richard had taken, you know, 6 years to write it, and it was like the length of Tolstoy, and it's a brilliant book and a brilliant writer who did a brilliant job and sold like, you know, hundreds of copies.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, now in its afterlife, it has sold some more, but it still was a vast commercial failure.
Uh-huh.
And so the days when Hunter Thompson had hits with Fear and Loathing on the Campaign Trail were a long time ago. And the publishing business had basically decided that campaign books wouldn't sell. And then the internet made them think it even more so, because their attitude was, there's so much coverage out there, there can't be anything interesting that isn't already out there. Like, what could you possibly tell us about the campaign that we don't already know, given right. the amount of coverage there is? And Mark and I, when we first thought about doing Game Change, we looked at that presupposition and were like, no, that's wrong. First of all, it's wrong because the nature of coverage now is like little kids at a soccer game. It's like the ball gets kicked down one end of the field and everybody chases the ball, and then it gets kicked down to the other end and they chase the ball. But you obsess over a certain question, like how did Sarah Palin get on the ticket? Everyone obsesses about that for 3 days. But the ball then gets kicked down to the other end of the field and the pack races after the ball and the question remains unanswered. Uh-huh. So in like the spring of 2008, we sat there and said, well, do you like really know how Barack Obama decided to run? Like that he could really beat Hillary Clinton? And we were both like, I don't really know the answer to that question. And we both have been covering the Clintons for a long time. And we both said, like, do you really know what the role of Bill Clinton has been in his wife's campaign? And we were like, no, I really don't know. I mean, I know a few things about this and that, but I don't really know that. Well, those are pretty big questions.
Yeah.
Like, and there's a lot of coverage. And still, we don't know the answer to those questions. And the Palin thing came up 3 months later. But again, it was the same kind of thing. Huge, big question. Everyone's curious. We follow this as closely as anyone, and we don't know the answer. So that tells you something about the fact that there are still big questions left to answer. And it tells you that the nature of coverage, though the coverage is intense and minute by minute and overwhelming, it's still somehow the nature of the coverage is not focusing on and getting at some of those things. So when we went to sell the book, we said, there were no other books. Like, it was amazing. It was April of 2008. The Obama Clinton race had been like the greatest thing we'd ever seen. And no one but like Dan Balls, who's a great guy and a great reporter, but Dan was like doing this book, but no one else was doing a book. And we went around to a bunch of publishers and said, you know, guys, first of all, this campaign is actually really special. And second of all, we have a theory. Our proposal was, we wrote out like 4 or 5 scenes based on what we knew at that point about some of these characters, like a Hillary scene, a Barack scene, an Edwards scene, a McCain scene. And we said, this is kind of what the book will look like. And HarperCollins and a number of other publishers were like, well, that might sell. But to answer your original question, we thought we had a lot of things in the book that were interesting, and we thought they were news. And the truth is that to sell hundreds of thousands of books, you need to have, I think, you need for the book to be good. And the second thing is, you have to get lucky, and like, you have to have like a kind of lightning strike quality. You have to have news that can be promoted and sold on television and get people to pay attention and stuff.
The thing that we did not think was news in the book was this thing about Harry Reid saying that Barack Obama had no Negro dialect except when he wanted to have one. We didn't think it was news. We didn't promote it as news in the pre-publicity. It was never in any material. And I, again, one of my the most vivid memories I will ever have in my life was sitting at Momofuku Noodle Bar on Saturday afternoon with my wife and looking down at my phone and seeing that some guy, Mark Ambender, this blogger, had gotten a book that had found a book in a bookstore in Washington. The embargo had broken a couple days earlier. And we had set up the 60 Minutes was going to be the big break, which was Palin and Steve Schmidt on Sunday night. And that was going to be the big break for the book. And the book was embargoed. Mark Ambender had picked up this book at Kramer Books in Washington, D.C. And he seized on the Harry Reid thing and had called Reid's office and said, like, what's the deal? And Reid had immediately came out and admitted that he said it and apologized. And I was sitting there looking at this going, oh my God, like the Senate Majority Leader just apologized for this thing that we didn't like really think was news. And then by 2 o'clock in the afternoon, the president issued a statement saying, I accept Harry Reid's apology. And at that point we knew like, okay, this thing's like out of control.
Yeah.
And it was now on the front page of the Sunday New York Times. All of a sudden it was this runaway train and we hadn't even gotten to 60 Minutes yet. But then the next night, you had Sarah Palin on 60 Minutes, which is the biggest book-selling television venue in America. And the combination, that 1-2 punch, which really was like one thing we totally planned and one thing we totally didn't plan. But those two things together created this firestorm where, you know, we sold, you know, like 100,000 books in a day. On Monday.
That's insane.
You know, yeah. I mean, it was like we stood in this Barnes & Noble, and I can't tell you, like, the weird, again, another one of these memories I'll never forget, standing in the Barnes & Noble at, like, in, like, Columbus Circle, and they were bringing in stacks of the book, like, that were, like, 50 high, and we stood there and watched the stacks, like, go down. Like we stood there for 20 minutes, and, like, people, like, 50 would get bought in 10 minutes, and then, like, more people would come in and buy more. And we stood there just looking at it going like, this is the most incredible fucked up weird thing I've ever had in my life. There's like, you couldn't dream, like, so this is my long way of answering your question. Did you expect it to be like that? No, I did not expect it to be like that. And it was weird and like, oh man, this is crazy.
A part of all this is that you started appearing on TV. Now are on MSNBC all the time, and then you've got this new gig at Bloomberg, so presumably you'll be on TV a lot there.
Yeah.
And I'm curious, like, when that started happening, obviously that's a good thing for like getting your writing out into the world. And, you know, I mean, you're like a reporter's reporter. I think people who see you on TV don't necessarily know that. There's a guy just opines about politics that anyone on TV does. But did you have a fear like this is going to cause me to not be taken as seriously being a kind of talking head on TV?
I didn't have that fear at all. I discovered very early. You know, I mean, much earlier than this, I remember, you know, the first few times I ever went on television back in the mid-90s, but, you know, like going on Charlie Rose to sell the Microsoft story, you know, when we published, that sold the story. Like, it was part of the thing. It's like, and if you're a writer, like, and you're not like an asshole, in my opinion, you want the maximum number of people to read your stuff. And there's nothing wrong with that. That's like, that's what this is, you know, there's no great glory in cultivating some weird niche audience, right?
Yeah.
You know? I do this work because I believe in what I'm doing and I'm not trying to compromise my principles or my standards to get a larger audience. But once I have written the thing of which I feel confident and proud and feel as though is ethically and journalistically sound, I then want the maximum number of people to read it. My job is partly to go out and sell that story so that somebody will go and buy that magazine to like keep that magazine at some level close to profitability. So it'll continue to be able to subsidize the work of great, you know, restaurant critics and film critics and reporters like me. That's, you know, that's how you sell magazines, right? So it's not just selling your own work. It's also supporting the institution that supports you.
Right.
You know, the weird thing is, you know, there's like this whole bunch of people who watch cable TV who, like, frankly, like, just don't read, you know, or I don't know what they read, but like, you know, people I get who stop me on the street, you know, who like think I'm the TV guy.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, Morning Joe guy, you know, Hardball guy, you know, Lawrence O'Donnell guy. You're that guy. You're the TV guy. Chris Matthews show. I know you. Yeah, blah, 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 blah. And then there's people who come up to me like, you know, at a restaurant and say like, you know, I love your column in New York Magazine. I read it every week. And like, I love the books and I read the books and whatever. And they don't say anything about the TV. You know, I didn't really start out understanding that. I sort of assumed that like somehow there would be some crossover.
So you now you're moving on to do this thing at Bloomberg. I feel like we don't need to talk about it in depth because you haven't even started it yet. But at some point later in the future, we'll have you back to talk about
As long as there's more bullet rye.
There's always rye available.
As long as there's another bottle of bullet rye in the Atomist studios, I'll be back, you know, next week.
But I have two part question, which is maybe connected. So both of the books have been very successful. Does that set you up? I mean, do you feel like a pressure, like the next thing has to be bigger? And then the other part of it is, do you get tired of politics? I mean, is there a point at which you say, like, I don't want to do another fucking campaign. Like, I've seen it all. Like, nothing could happen in this campaign that could possibly be new to me. Or is it all, does it feel new when it comes around again?
Well, the second question, I'll answer the question as not yet. You know, I can imagine a day when I say, you know, I think I want to sit this one out and I want to go write about something else. I mean, I can imagine that. I've done it, you know, because I've switched back and forth between politics and business, and maybe I'll go write about sports or go write about music or go write about, you know, food or something else at some point. I can easily imagine a day when I'm like, I kind of like feel like I've done the politics thing. Like, mm-hmm. I can't, I mean, it's totally possible that after this cycle that I'll say that. It's also possible that I won't. I don't know. But at this moment, I'm not tired of politics. And so, and this campaign seems like it's going to be a pretty exciting one. So we're psyched about doing it. I think that that it's not pressure to do something bigger or anything. It's just more that, like, you know, we may or may not do a third book. But it was more for me, at least, to do this thing at Bloomberg, which is this kind of ambitious multi-platform thing of starting a politics news vertical operation across platforms within an existing media company that has a lot of resources. So you can spend money to do quality stuff, which is rare in our business at this point. You know,
sort of going back to the Louis Rossetto Wired thing. Like, what kind of money does it take to do this
takes
right?
It takes money to make good stuff. And so, like, there's money at Bloomberg. That's just a fact. And the terminal business, you know, subsidizes that, you know, creates a business that throws off billions of dollars a year in free cash flow. And some of that gets diverted into this news operation that they have built over there. And so we get to take a little bit of that money and make a new thing. And so that's enticing. As someone at The Atavist might appreciate, like, the notion of doing a startup is kind of like appealing. I've never done that. So even though it's not a pure startup in the sense that it's not like a venture-driven startup, it's still a startup in the sense that, like, we have an idea, we're going to hire a bunch of people, and we're going to execute that idea. And you could consider Mike Bloomberg our venture capitalist, you know, who's funding us. But it has a startup flavor and feel to it. I had never done that before. That was appealing. The cross-platform thing of, like, doing a TV show and doing a website that had a lot of digital video on it and then having events attached to that. That also was really appealing because there's not that many places you can really do it. I don't really know there's anywhere you can do it. You know, it's like the idea of doing something that has that capacity is unique.
Really, your answer to the question is you are doing something bigger.
Yes. I mean, but who knows? It could be a total failure. I mean, it wasn't a pressure like we need to now top ourselves.
Right.
That's not why we did it. It was more like I felt like after having done personally, that after having been at New York Magazine for now almost 9 years, I was like ready to try something different. And so a place where I can still write is great. But the idea of being able to the startup quality of this, which is different from what I was doing before, and not just being a magazine writer who appears on TV, having an ownership of the thing and a creative role in deciding what the editorial voice of the thing would be and then helping to execute that. I feel like I've done two full presidential cycles in New York Magazine. Like, I'm ready to, like, you know, like, go on and, like, try something a little different.
All right. Cool.
Right.
That sounds great.
Well, we'll see.
Well, thanks for coming into this little podcast.
Yeah, the podcast.
It's not TV.
It's not TV, but it's great. And they don't always give me bullet rye when I go. Not always. Sometimes at MSNBC, they have a bottle for me, but not always. Maybe at the Bloomberg studios, this is what we'll have as our morning jolt.
I recommend it. That's it for this week's Longform Podcast. Thanks for listening. Thanks to John Heilemann for coming on this week. Thanks to my co-hosts, Max Linsky and Aaron Lammer of Longform. I'm Evan Ratliff from Atavist. As always, our editor, Jenna Weiss-Berman, is the one that makes this happen. And also our intern, Tim Maddox. Thanks to our sponsor, Tiny Letter, and we will catch you next week.
Why do you run? Why does anyone?
I always thought that runners loved running, and that's not the case. Most runners hate running, but they choose to do it.
In the new docuseries, Running Sucks, brought to you by Team Milk, Abby Ayers learns why women runners everywhere are driven to go the distance.
It really is about taking my power back and proving myself wrong.
Team Milk is about fueling women's performance and helping them along their marathon journeys. You can sign up now for the inaugural Every Woman's Marathon taking place in Savannah, Georgia on November 16th, 2024. Learn more and register at everywomansmarathon.com.